Welcome to Teck Resources Q2 earnings call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. This conference call is being recorded on Thursday, July 23rd, 2015. I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Rick Waller, Vice President, Investor Relations and Strategic Analysis. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks very much, operator. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us this morning for Teck's second quarter 2015 results conference call. Before we begin, I'd like to draw your attention to the forward-looking information on slide two. This presentation does contain forward-looking statements regarding our business. However, various risks and uncertainties may cause actual results to vary. Teck does not assume the obligation to update any forward-looking statement. With that, I'd like to turn the call over to Don Lindsay, our President and CEO.
Thanks, Greg, and good morning, everyone. I will begin with a brief overview of our second quarter results, and then Ron Millos, our CFO, will provide additional color from a financial perspective. We will then close with a Q&A session when Ron and myself and several other additional members of our senior management team would be happy to answer any questions. Our industry continues to face difficult conditions. In Q2, prices for all of our major commodities were lower than the same quarter last year. Steelmaking coal spot prices have fallen by around $25 per ton from the start of the year as the market continues to be oversupplied. We are responding to these conditions with our ongoing focus on cost management and operational performance. We continue to lower unit costs, helped significantly by lower oil prices and the U.S. dollar remaining at favorable levels in the quarter and, in fact, strengthening in July. We will continue to have a disciplined approach to managing our mine production and inventory and began rotating temporary shutdowns at each of our six coal operations in June. Improved gross profit before depreciation and amortization in each of our business units this quarter reflects our close attention to costs. In addition, we have taken steps to significantly enhance our liquidity. In Q2, we extended our existing revolving line of credit by 1 year, and we added a new 2-year, $1.2 billion U.S. dollar facility. Also, subsequent to quarter end, we announced changes to our gold streaming arrangement at Andacollo, which generated an additional $162 million U.S. dollars in cash. In total, we currently have over $6.5 billion Canadian dollars in liquidity, including our undrawn credit facilities. Finally, we were honored to be recognized again as one of the top corporations in Canada for both corporate citizenship and social responsibility. Teck is fourth-ranked company overall and the top-ranked mining company on Corporate Knights' Best 50 Corporate Citizens in Canada list. We were also named one of the top 50 socially responsible corporations in Canada by Sustainalytics. Looking at the overview of our second quarter results on slide four, revenue of $2 billion was flat to Q2 last year, but gross profit was up 6%, again reflecting the results of our cost management program. Overall profitability was down by $17 million at $63 million due to a higher provisional tax rate, much of which is a one-time item related to the recent increase in Alberta's provincial tax rates implemented there by the new government. After removing unusual items, though, adjusted profit attributable to shareholders was actually up $7 million from the same period last year to $79 million, or 14 cents per share, despite lower commodity prices. Touching on some operational highlights from the second quarter on slide five, our operations performed well. Production was up for all of our major products, and this includes production from Ponderay, which completed its restart in the quarter and is expected to achieve its annualized production capacity of 44,000 tons of zinc concentrate by the end of Q3. We also reduced unit costs in both copper and coal by 9 and 10% respectively. I will now review our quarterly results by business unit, starting with steelmaking coal on slide six. While sales were 300,000 tons lower in the quarter, they were higher than our quarterly guidance at 6.5 million tons, and we achieved record sales in the first half of the year. That is, our sales were 6.5 million tons, and the guidance for you will be at 6. However, ongoing oversupplied market conditions and indications of weakening demand in China continue to impact coal prices. Spot prices were down close to $15 per ton in the quarter and even lower during the middle of the quarter. And since roughly half of our sales were priced on shorter-term pricing arrangements, our realized price came in at the low end of the historical range at 87% of the quarterly benchmark. On a Canadian dollar basis, our average realized price was down $6 per ton to $116. Production was up 200,000 tons in the quarter compared to last year. And this was prior to our decision to take temporary shutdowns beginning in late June. We also significantly reduced coal site costs by $8 per ton, and transportation costs were also lower. Costs have fallen even further in U.S. dollar terms. Gross profit before depreciation and amortization was actually up 6% to $215 million. Looking forward, as I mentioned earlier, we have begun temporary shutdowns at each of our coal operations for the third quarter and reduced our production guidance by approximately 1.5 million tons. At the same time, we maintained our annual coal cost guidance and reduced our annual capitalized stripping guidance by $65 million. We have said that we will consider additional production adjustments as market conditions evolve, and we plan to review our Q4 production levels around the end of September. We continue to support our long-term customers. For Q3, coal prices have been agreed with the majority of our customers based on $93 per ton for the highest quality product, and we expect sales to be at least 6 million tons, including spot sales. Turning to our base metals businesses and starting with copper on slide 7, revenue was up 8% to $704 million. Average realized price was down 13% in U.S. dollar terms, and sales were up by 10,000 tons. Production was 6,000 tons higher than the same quarter last year and 12,000 tons higher than Q1 of this year. We reduced our total cash unit cost by 15 cents per pound, or 9% on a U.S. dollar basis, and that's in line with our guidance for a significant reduction this year. Gross profit before depreciation and amortization was up 8% to $317 million. At QB, we temporarily suspended cathode production on June 25th following an unexpected ground movement in the SXEW plant area. Partial production has since resumed. The impact on production in the second half of the year is expected to be 5 to 10,000 tons of copper cathode. As a result, we now expect full-year copper production of 340 to 350,000 tons. That's in the bottom half of our previous guidance range. And finally, as planned, Duck Pond ceased operations on June 30th after exhausting its remaining reserves. Looking at our zinc business unit on slide 8, and please note that Antamina and Duck Pond zinc-related results are reported in our copper business unit as usual. Duck Pond officially closed on June 30th. Ponderay achieved commercial production at the end of the first quarter, so its earnings have been included in our profit since April 1st. Lower zinc concentrate sales were due to normal seasonal variability at Red Dog, and higher refined zinc sales were more reflective of the production rate at Trail. Red Dog's shipping season commenced on June 28th, and we expect sales of 170,000 tons of contained zinc in Q3 and 200,000 tons in Q4, consistent with the normal seasonal sales pattern. Production of zinc concentrate was up, principally at Red Dog, as it continues to benefit from excellent ore throughput and also including Ponderay's contribution. As I mentioned earlier, Ponderay's restart was completed in the quarter. The mill reached design capacity of 2,000 tons per day of ore throughput in June. Annualized production capacity of 44,000 tons of zinc concentrate is expected to be achieved by the end of Q3. Lower refined lead production was driven by our annual KivSet shutdown, which was advanced to Q2 from Q3, as well as a reduction in throughput due to furnace conditions. Overall, gross profit before depreciation and amortization was 2% higher at $143 million. Turning to an update on Fort Hills on slide 9, we are well into construction, and all critical milestones are being achieved as per plan. As of the end of Q2, engineering activities were 85% complete. Construction was 35% complete, and we would expect to be more than half done by year end. At that point, we will be only 18 months away from commissioning. These photos give you a sense of the scale of the construction. Equipment and material deliveries are continuing, and off-site modular fabrication, site civil works, and process facility construction are now well underway. As I've said before, this is a great environment to be building an asset like Fort Hills. With capital spending having been reduced in the industry substantially, there is a lot less pressure on labor and contractors. And while we are very pleased with the progress of the project and the cost management, with the project only 35% complete, it is too early to declare victory on budget and schedule. Look forward to the completion of the project and the addition to earnings and cash flow that we expect it to generate. And with that, I will turn it over to Ron Millos for the financial highlights for the quarter.
Thanks, Don. I've summarized our changes in cash for the quarter on slide 10. Our cash flow from operations was $332 million. We spent $329 million on capital projects, including Fort Hills. Capitalized stripping costs were $175 million. We paid $39 million in our interest on our debt and $42 million of principal. And Antamina refinanced a loan of which our portion was $28 million. After these items, distribution to non-controlling interests, foreign exchange translation, and other changes in working capital, we ended the quarter with cash and short-term investments of around $1.3 billion. And this is in line with our expectations for this point in the year. And with the changes to the Andacollo gold streams that Don spoke to earlier, our current cash balance is approximately $1.5 billion as of July 22nd. Moving on to the next slide, our pricing adjustments for the first quarter. Lower prices resulted in $32 million of negative pricing adjustments in Q2, compared with positive pricing adjustments of $19 million in the same period last year. Copper was down 13 cents from the end of Q1 2015, and zinc was down 4 cents. These adjustments are included in our income statement under other operating income and expense. And the chart on the right represents the simplified relationships between the change in copper and zinc prices and the reported settlement adjustments, and usually provides a good estimate of our pricing adjustments each quarter. And as always, as a reminder, refining and treatment charges and the Canadian-US dollar exchange rate should be considered in your analysis of the impact of price changes in the adjustment, and you should also consider taxes and royalties when analyzing the impact on our profit. Looking at our credit ratings on slide 12, our credit ratings were recently put on negative outlooks by S&P and Moody's due to the current economic environment. And our investment-grade credit ratings continue to be a priority for us. However, if commodity price moves further against us, there is a limit to what makes sense to defend it. We've executed on a number of initiatives that are supportive of our credit rating. We're consistently delivering on our operational targets and have achieved significant cost reductions. We've minimized capital spending and are really funding only one growth project, being Fort Hills. And we have cut the dividend to 30 cents per share on an annualized basis, beginning with the July payment. We've also implemented production curtailments at the coal operations while maintaining our coal cost guidance. We've enhanced our cash position through changes to our gold streaming arrangement at Andacollo, with the potential for further streaming transactions, particularly in silver. And we've enhanced our liquidity through additional committed bank credit, and I'll speak to that momentarily. We believe that the quality of our long-life assets and their positioning on the commodity cost curves, our actions to diversify our commodity basket, and our financial policies are all supportive of investment-grade credit rating we continue to target as appropriate for tech. Turning to liquidity on slide 13, as Don mentioned earlier, we've recently taken steps to significantly enhance our liquidity. We now have two undrawn revolving credit facilities totaling U.S. $4.2 billion. We extended the maturity on our U.S. $3 billion revolving facility by 1 year to July 2020 and put in place a new $1.2 revolving facility maturing in June 2017. And again, subsequent to quarter end, we restructured the agreement with Royal Gold at Andacollo, which generated the additional U.S. $162 million cash. And the rating agencies have confirmed that that transaction is not treated as debt. And again, including these proceeds, our current cash balance is $1.2 billion as of the end of day yesterday. In total, our cash and unused available committed bank credit is now over C$6.5 billion. And this is about four times of our share of CapEx remaining at the Fort Hills project, not including the free cash flow generation from the rest of our business. These credit lines are fully available to us regardless of our credit rating. The cost of facilities, drawn or undrawn, would become more expensive if our credit rating were to decline, but there is no credit rating trigger regarding availability. The credit facilities contain one financial covenant, and that is to maintain a debt-to-debt plus equity ratio of not greater than 50%. We are currently at 32%, and regarding commonly voiced concerns we hear these days regarding write down room, our equity would have to drop by about $10 billion to be offside that 50% ratio. Our current cash balance is in line with our expectations for this time of the year and is consistent with our goal of ending the year with at least $1 billion. Assuming that we meet our current full-year guidance for production volumes, costs, and capital spending, you know, based on current commodity prices and exchange rates, and also assuming that we have no unusual transactions or events by the end of the year. And with that, I'll turn it back to Don for comment.
Thanks, Ron. And before I wrap up, I'd like to reinforce what Ron said about some of the speculation and comments we've heard in the market. And this is related to the investment grade rating and actions that we may or may not take. As Ron said, we believe that with our diversification strategy and with the quality and long lives of our assets and our positioning on the cost curves for our key commodities, Teck should be considered an investment grade company over the long term. However, if commodity prices move in such a fashion against us that our debt to EBITDA metric is stressed for the short term and the rating agencies decide, which is their right, to move us out of investment grade for some time, then there isn't much more we can do to defend that. We will not issue equity to buy back debt to defend the rating. And that's one of the comments that we've heard in the market. We want to make sure that, people understand that we will not issue equity to buy back debt to defend the rating. We will continue to invest in our business and to restore the EBITDA side of that metric. To wrap up with a summary of our near-term priorities on slide 14, we remain focused on cost reductions and operating performance. At the same time, we are maintaining a strong financial position, and we expect to finish the year with at least $1 billion in cash without any material change in our overall U.S. dollar debt level. With that, we would be happy to answer your questions, and I want to say please note that some of our management team members are on the line in different locations, and so there may be a brief pause after you ask your question as we sort out who's going to run through. Thank you very much, and over to you, operator.
Thank you, sir. We will now take questions from the telephone lines. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. Please limit your inquiry to one question plus a follow-up question. After that, if you have further questions, please rejoin the queue. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, you may press the pound sign. So please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause allowing you to register. Thank you for your patience. Our first question is from Sasha Bukacheva from BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. Don, thank you very much for an update. Are you able at this time to give us an idea of the magnitude or at least a range of those additional ongoing coal production cuts and also the cost profile associated with that volume?
No, we are not. As we said in the comments, we're going to make that decision in September. Ian, you're on the line. Maybe I'll ask you to comment related to the cost side of it.
Yeah, sure, Don. We're continuing to maintain our operations cash positive over Q3. We'll be looking at Q4 to see what the market expectation or the market trends are, and we'll be maintaining the production that we have that's cash positive. And at this point, we expect that to be all of our mines. However, we can't predict what's going to happen in the market in the next 4 months, so we'll be making any decisions as to production levels around September.
Okay, and then a follow-up question on that, I guess. Well, your stripping costs at, in the coal division are still quite high versus operating income. At $100 million, that was about half of the gross profit. So is there any chance that those additional production cuts would help with the stripping cost reductions or maybe some deferrals?
Of course, our ongoing cost cutting is important. We've been reducing costs for several years now, and all of our people are still working very hard at that. So we'll be looking to continue to reduce costs right across our range of costs. When we look at how we performed in the first half of the year compared to our budget and compared to costs in the previous year. We reduced costs in every category. That is in labour, in contractors, in operating supplies, repair parts, diesel, and other costs. So we are confident that we can maintain that momentum.
Right. So, but you wouldn't really want to speak to any of the ranges right now. We'd have to wait till September to kind of get a better sense of the numbers.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll jump back in the queue.
I point out that with the degree of volatility we've seen in the last 2 weeks, let alone the last 2 months or 6 months, it's very hard to make decisions in this volatile environment, so we're going to wait till the end of the quarter.
The following question is from Harry Mateer from Barclays. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. A couple questions. I guess first, Don, in the past you have indicated that you might be willing to issue equity to buy assets. Can you just talk about what you're seeing in that market? Are there any opportunities, or is that just not viable with your equity at this level?
Yeah, I just sort of add some clarity to the comment. The nature of the questioning at the time, this was on the last quarterly caller, probably any time anyone's asked me a question, you always have to get to a situation where you say never say never. But our bias is strongly against issuing equity at all anywhere near these price levels. And if it were for an acquisition, it would have to be quite an extraordinary acquisition for us to think that it was so accretive that we would issue equity. So that's the one point on issuing equity. On what we're seeing in the acquisitions market, not much. You can read in the papers about different activities that are ongoing, but the odds of us being sort of involved at a point where we'd actually make an acquisition are quite slim at the best of times, and I don't think anything's changed. The fact is, when the industry went through its consolidation phase from about 10 years ago to 5 years ago, a lot of the good opportunities were taken then, and they're held in strong hands, and they're unlikely to free up, at least opportunities we'd be interested in. And exploration worldwide generally hasn't been that successful. And where there are discoveries, one thing we've learned as an industry is that it's at least 10, 12 years, probably 15, before there'd be any production from those discoveries. And so if you're looking to grow near to medium-term production and cash flow, there's very, very little out there.
Thanks. And then just to follow up, as a management team, I don't know if this is something you manage too, but what do you think the right debt or net debt EBITDA metric is for the company?
Our CFO will give you our policy on that.
Yeah, our target is geared to maintain the mid-BBB credit rating, and the 30% number is what we've targeted in the past. Certainly at these commodity prices, it's challenging to maintain that, but the 30%, in a more normal pricing environment is a reasonable target for us.
And that's a debt-to-cap target?
That's debt-to-debt plus equity. Of course, the rating agencies look at EBITDA coverage and interest coverage. They have a number of different metrics that they look at. So, but our financial policies are tied into trying to maintain that mid-BBB level. And, we like the mid-BBB because, when you get into an environment like this, you end up getting sort of drawn down with the entire industry, and it leaves us that sort of notch of cushion to avoid the non-investment grade categories.
Yeah, I might just add to that the issue with the debt-to-EBITDA ratio is really with the denominator. If you look at our debt maturity schedule, we only have $300 million due this year, nothing due next year, and then the maturity ladder is well staggered throughout with very, very manageable maturities. So it's really about EBITDA, and in the extremely low price environment, or low coal price in particular, it's tough to do much about that EBITDA. It doesn't take much change in the coal price for that fraction, for the denominator to increase such that the fraction is right back on side. However, we'll have to wait and see if or more likely when that happens.
I guess to that point, where do you think we are on the met coal cost curve at this point?
Well, that's, I think it's an excellent question, but one of the most difficult to answer in the industry right now. I'm looking at Rail Foley as I speak, but, you know, the whole industry has been able to lower costs certainly more than I think anyone anticipated. We've done a pretty good job ourselves, and we're trying to make sure we maintain our position on that cost curve. But I think it would be just a guess as to know where we are right now. But, Rail, do you have anything better to say?
Maybe just more generally, Don, like Wood Mac's estimate a couple months ago was showing that around half of the seaborne hard coking coal industry was operating at negative margin, and that was based on a price of $89. So since then, the spot price has come down further. So you can expect that at least half of the industry is still operating cash negative. And in our case, we're cash positive at all of our mines.
I mean, the currency effect, of course, is very powerful. It's helped us in Canada. It certainly helped Australia and doesn't help the U.S. We have seen an acceleration in the U.S. of what I call corporate activity, I guess. You know, I think there have been six bankruptcies so far, including Walter recently. There's been delisting of Alpha. Arch is, I think, consolidating 10-for-1 to avoid delisting. You know, these are serious indications of how stressed the industry is. There was a report out from one of the major banks a few days ago saying 100% of the Central Appalachian coal business is losing cash. So we know that there's a lot of pressure out there, but, you know, at this point, the market's still oversupplied.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The following question is from Greg Barnes from TD Securities. Please go ahead.
So, Don, how oversupplied is the coal industry right now, given there have been cuts in production, including your own?
Well, good question, Greg. And as you all know, we keep a running chart on this, and we have a number. I don't think we share the number because we're not sure how accurate it is. But, you know, I want to be helpful, so I think we've set a range before, so I'd say we're still in the 10 to 15 million ton oversupply range.
And I know this is an equally difficult question, but...
You know what I want to say, though, because I see Rail staring at me, because there's a part B to that, and that depends on your assumption on what the imports into China are. And when I talked about volatility earlier, I mean, this would be a good case in point. In May, the total met coal imports into China were 1.8 million tons. And then we just saw June's number, and it was 5.08 million tons. So if you annualize the 5.08, that's over 60 million tons a year. That would be fantastic, right? Of course, we know that it's just shipping schedules and various other things. So to answer your first question on how oversupplied are we, you have to make an estimate or a guess on what the numbers are going to be going to China, what the end demand are. I saw another comment out saying that you know, one of the factors that might bring the coal market back, coal price back, is that we're all underestimating what China will buy from the seaborne market. We don't know. We'll just have to see how it unfolds month by month. It's the absolute right question, Greg, but geez, it's tough to answer.
Yeah. So an equally difficult question then. What is the right long-term price for coking coal now? And I know you use 185 in your replacement or carrying value test, but clearly that's not right. What is right?
Well, and what we said, there's a long paragraph in our disclosure about that because we spent a lot of time on it, and thanks for the opportunity to maybe elaborate on that. First of all, again, we don't know the long-term price, and the other factor going into that assumption is what is the long-term cost structure. And that hasn't stabilized yet. And so, and it hasn't stabilized for us either. Because as price gets lower, people change their mine plans. And in some cases, that can change cost structure quite significantly, as you all know. So, for example, we have our impairment testing. The last time it was done was in October, which is the same time we do annually for the goodwill testing. And at that time, I think the Canadian dollar was closer to par or something. So if you then use current exchange rates, actually if you use a 125 exchange rate versus that 185, it takes it down to about 140, and then if you use current exchange rates, it takes it down to about 104. And then if you were able to use a model with our current costs and what we think our costs are likely to be in the new five-year mine plans going forward, then that might be the equivalent, that might get us below 130 in terms of where we think there might be any impairment. So that's really one part of the discussion. Does that mean that the long-term price is 130 or below? We don't know, because if we look at other operations and where the top 10 to 20% of the cost curve is, we think it's going to be above that. We've seen some disclosure lately that reinforces that. So we're doing a lot of work on it, and it's very important for people modeling and doing valuations and so on. I don't think we'll find that the cost reductions, the kind of percent cost reductions that we've seen in the last 2 years, will continue much longer. I think people are going to hit the wall on that. And in fact, you'll see some snapback and costs will come back up because the things that people did to sort of survive these extreme lows will run out. And if they want to stay in business, they'll have to mine higher cost material. So, it's just another form of volatility in trying to assess this business. So, again, I don't know if that's a helpful answer or not. We're trying to be helpful, but the answers are not easy to your questions, which is, of course, something you knew.
No, that is helpful, Don. That gets us some way down the road on this. Thanks a lot. Thank you. The following question is from Orest Wagada from Scotiabank. Please go ahead.
Hi. Just wanted to get a little bit more color on the coal business. You've done a pretty good job taking down costs over the last year or so. Do you think we've kind of reached the bottom on where costs can go, given that you're taking volumes down starting in the third quarter? I'm curious if you still think there is more room to bring down costs from current levels. And then secondary, in terms of volumes, if the spot price stays around $80 a ton, which would signal that we'll see even a lower benchmark moving forward, do you think it's reasonable to assume that, your volumes could be, would stay around that 5.7 to 6 million ton per quarter mark moving forward until we saw an improvement?
Okay, I'm going to make some comments and then turn it over to Ian in a minute. And working backwards on your questions, it's still too early to tell on that. Directionally, I think that if prices stayed that low, we'd probably stay in the range we are now. But we are looking at a number of different alternatives that could change that decision. So, I apologize, but there isn't just one option for us on that, and we haven't made the decision, so I don't want to be definitive. On the cost thing, if you asked me about 4 or 5 months ago, I would have thought, yeah, we're getting close to, having done just about all that we can do. But, imagination prevails, and mine plan is a big, big part of it. If you assume that we're in an environment of lower prices for longer, then you could make some significant decisions on mine plan that structurally lower your costs. And so we know the whole industry is looking at that, so we are too. Plus, there's different technology applications. One of the things that we're excited about is converting our haul trucks from diesel to LNG, and not only is that a very important move from a sustainability point of view in terms of lowering your carbon footprint, but it's also going to lower our costs, our fuel costs, significantly. So there's a bunch of things that could make a difference. So, Ian, why don't I turn it over to you on that point on the cost side?
Thanks, Don. Yes, well, I guess we just continue to look for cost reduction opportunities. Basically, all our employees in the coal business unit are engaged in this in one form and another, and we're working at the highest priority and highest impact cost reduction initiatives. We're talking to all our suppliers. We're talking to all of our contractors. We're examining the services that we have provided to us to look for opportunities. We're looking to continue to consolidate our purchasing effort, looking for increased leverage. We're looking at mine plans. We've been able to reduce haul distances this year below budget, basically questioning the various assumptions under which we've been formulating our mine plans. So I wouldn't say we're at the finish of our cost reduction capability. We're certainly a fair way through. We've achieved a lot, but we're going to be keeping on looking.
Okay, thank you for that. And just as a follow-up, you've spent about $1 billion year to date on CapEx, all in, including cap stripping in Fort Hills. You seem to be tracking below your budget for the year of 2.3. Do you expect that to pick up in the second half, or is there a possibility you might come in below budget on that spending?
Ron Mills?
We think we might come in a bit lower. The one significant item that Don mentioned earlier was reduced stripping costs at the coal operations. Of course, our U.S. based operations, they're being hit by the exchange rate. But I wouldn't say it's going to come in hundreds of millions of dollars below by any means. But it could come in $100 million or so below.
Okay, thanks for that color.
Thank you. The following question is from Jeffrey McKinney from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, guys, and thank you for the question. I guess first on the just some further clarity on the additional liquidity that was put in place. Curious why the decision for a 2-year facility. Was there nothing available from a longer term standpoint? Generally don't think of liquidity as a near term concern. So just kind of wanted to get your thoughts there.
Scott Wilson, our Vice President of Treasury.
Thanks, Jeffrey. The decision on the $1.2 billion tenor of 2 years was really a balance between a longer term there, but also extending our existing $3 billion facility. So we extended that from a 4-year term to a 5-year term, and in conjunction with that, felt and took advice from our banking relationships that a 2-year term in terms of capital that the banks would need to hold against these things was about the right sweet spot. So it was really to find that optimal balance.
And was there a longer term facility available, or was this kind of as far as kind of lending, banks were willing to go out?
We might have been able to do something longer. I'm not sure we would have been able to get $1.2 billion had we done that. So, again, it was trying to find the right balance between size and tenor.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. And then just kind of revisiting the comments on some of the other coal producers. You mentioned Walter and Alpha. As you think about kind of your intermediate term strategy, what are you guys thinking about in terms of that that capacity potentially being permanently shut versus continuing to operate post a potential reorganization?
It's hard to know. historically, if you went back to around the 2005 time period and before, the exports out of the U.S. were in the kind of 23 to 25 million ton range, kind of consistently. Then as prices rose, and they rose quite significantly, we saw those exports go up to as high, I think, 55 million tons, and kind of was in that range for a few years. If prices, you know, prices today are below, well, it's hard to pick a year, but, you know, certainly they're below 10 years ago, you know, would it go back to that level? If it did go back to the level, that would mean still significant shutdowns to come, permanent shutdowns to come out of a number of those companies. So that's probably the only kind of factual guideline that we can point to, but each of those will be case specific and they'll make their own decisions.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. Thank you. The following question is from Oscar Cabrera from Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Double whammy. Thank you, operator. Good morning, everyone. Don, just staying with the coal markets, wondering if you would be willing to share your estimates in those, you know, 10 to 15 million tons in oversupply. What's the assumption for imports into China?
You came through quite faintly, sorry, Oscar, but I think the question was what our assumption was for imports into China. And I think, you know, in our chart and coming to 10 to 15, there's a number of factors, and we'd probably be best not to go into those details. But, you know, I can say that for 6 months, like at the half year, it was 21 million tons into China. You annualize that, that's 42. Monthly was much higher, but May was really not much. So, I mean, it's very volatile. It's hard to tell.
Yeah. But, I mean, I'm assuming that you were using the first 6 months of the year, but now that's fine. That's helpful. Then on the, you know, you talked about the issues that you had in Quebrada Blanca as well as one of your coal mines with some slides. Do you have an estimate for the amount of capex that will be required to get these operations back to normal?
Dale Andrews, our Senior VP Copper.
I'll comment on briefly on QB. It's still early days as far as our cost assessments. We do have remediation plans that we're putting into place, and that includes plans to put a stabilization buttress against the pit wall. That's the primary cause of the ground movement in and around our SXCW plant. I think, again, it's too early to comment on the cost estimate, but as we stated in our release, we have restarted production at about 80% of planned production for the year, and we'll go at that rate until we finalize those plans.
Right, and on the coal operation?
Yeah, Ian here, Oscar. Probably in the order of a couple of million dollars. Basically, there was a fall of rock in the area between the mine and the plant. That has been cleaned up already to a significant degree, and now we've just got to get the conveyor running through, carrying the raw coal. Meanwhile, we're doing it by trucking, so it's going to be back to normal fairly soon.
Right, so, you know, marginal at best. And then the last thing, if I may, when you decided to shut down your operations for 3 weeks, what exchange were you using in your assumptions when that happened, Canadian exchange?
So the question was related to our 3 week shutdown, what exchange rate were we using?
Yeah, because, you know, if I remember correctly, back in the first quarter, you know, the operations were free cash flow positive, and then a few weeks hence, there was a decision to shut down the operations. So I'm assuming that part of the reason for that was the different Canadian exchange.
Okay, no, let me back up a bit on that and give some more color. So when we made the statement, that would have been in our Q1 results. So as of March 31st, all operations were cash positive. And then the coal price from about the middle of April to the middle of May declined substantially, like I think $20 in a very short space of time. And so for a phase there, depending upon whether you had maintenance shutdowns going or what, we would not have been able to have made that comment. So Ian and I then got together and the rest of the management team, and we implemented what we called our coal reset, where we literally wanted to reset the business. And we worked backwards from the market, from customer demand, and, different quality of demand in different markets. You know, China was one thing, but our percentage sales to China had declined quite a bit, and so it wasn't as big an impact as some people might believe, but that is where kind of the pricing discussions take place, but in elsewhere. And we decided to deliberately not put additional tons into an already oversupplied market. And that was my quote in the release, and that's something that we strongly believe in. So exchange rate didn't really have that much of an impact in the decision to cut production. It was really working back from customer demand, looking at our inventories at the ports and the mines, looking at just how we could be most efficient. And we did that very specifically so that it would have no effect on our key long-term customers, so we'd have the coal blends available that we wanted, and that's why we spread it throughout all six mines. And if we continue with that in the next quarter, and I repeat, we will not know that until the end of September, but we'd probably do it on the same basis, more or less. So that just gives more color on it. We were basically taking, spot tons off the market that were going to weaker hands that were kind of helping weaken the price. And you will have seen that when we did that, and we saw another producer, Peabody, cut back a few days later, there was a 10% move in the spot price. So we kind of think that that justifies the move.
Yeah.
Ian, did you want to make any additional comments? Sorry, I kind of...
No, thanks, Don. I think you covered it.
Okay. Thank you,
Don. That's a great call. Thanks.
Thank you. The following question is from Jorge Beristain from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, guys. I guess my question is for Ron Milos, but sorry, I joined the call late, so I'm not sure if he's on.
He is, yes.
Okay. I just again, addressing and just from taking a page from the gold stocks, I mean, they typically use sort of three-year trailing average gold prices to sort of mark to market their reserves. And I was wondering if Ron could comment on what is the mechanism for making that determination for when you do a mark to market on your reserves. And, given where the spot is relative to the, your reserve or your carrying price of $185 per ton. And then the other question is sort of, Ron, like how solid do you think Teck's book is right now? Because with the stock trading at about 25% of book value, I mean, the market's trying to tell you that there's probably some write-downs coming. So I'm just sort of looking for where we could be expecting those write-downs to originate. Thanks.
Yeah, I might get John Gingell to help out with the pricing, but generally speaking, it's what the market views the prices to be. So it's we look at the various what analysts do, what the various Wood Max those people look at, and what other companies are using type things. So plus our own views go into those calculations. So it's a number of things. The write-down also factors in the exchange rates, the mine plans, all of that information. So that's basically how we go about the impairment process. Market value is really just an indicator. It's something that if the market value of our shares are less than the book value, it's an indicator that something is wrong. The thing I might point out is You know, we looked at that in detail sometime in the last year. I can't remember the details. And I went back in history and looked at our market value. And at that time, about two-thirds of the time, our market value was well in excess of our book value, and a third of the time it was less. And when we were above, we were above by, on average, about $7 billion. And when we were below, we were below by about $2 billion type thing. So in a cyclical industry, you know, the market value of your shares against the book value is not that relevant in the overall scheme of things. So,
John, you want to comment?
Yeah, just a couple of comments. One is that the reserve testing prices are determined a little bit differently through a formula than the impairment testing numbers, so you can't make a direct correlation between them. And as I say, there's a specific formula that's required there. The other thing, just on the determination of prices, we use spot prices and forward markets where there are forward markets to determine those. But those forward markets for all our commodities run out after about 2 or 3 years. So after that period, we blend in our long-term prices. Our long-term prices, we go to a lot of sources for that. There's a management judgment involved in that. We do, when there are transactions in the market, we try to test our assumptions by back calculating the transaction price compared to the assumptions that we're using, and we're generally pretty good at that. They tend to tie in, but there haven't been a lot of transactions lately, so it gets a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, and I want to try to provide even more clarity, and it sounds like you may have missed my earlier answer earlier on the call, but we have some disclosure in the quarterly release as well on this. Important to note that the 185 number is not a number that is used in 2015 or 2016. It's several years out, and the numbers actually for these years are quite low, reflective of the market. That's when we do our models. Secondly, when that number was done, it was October 2014, and since that time, the combination of both exchange rates, which are, you know, Canadian dollars 130 or so now, and the reduction in costs would make as much as a $50 or more swing in that equivalent price. So we are looking at it very closely. We looked at it very closely for this quarter. We will look at it very closely for next quarter as well. And so there could be a write-down at some stage. But one of the most important factors will be get a handle on our own long-term cost structure, which comes down to decisions on mine plan and haulage distances and strip ratios, which can structurally affect the cost structure. You have to pick exchange rates, and as you know, that's quite difficult these days with the volatility. You'd also have to take a view on the long-term cost structure for the industry and how that might affect the long-term price. So we're very comfortable with this quarter because we know there's at least a $50 swing from what we published before, but we haven't come up to a definitive view on those key factors that I just listed. Because in this market, that's kind of difficult. And we are still working on those mine plans to see what decisions we might make that could materially affect the cost structure. So I hope that gives you some more color on your question.
And Jorge, if you missed the earlier part of the call, you know, there has been concern that, you know, the offsite are lending covenants with a potential write-down, and you know, our equity is $10 billion higher than our debt. So you've got basically $10 billion potential reduction in equity before we would be offside the debt covenant as well.
And just to add to that, that's an after-tax impairment. So you'd have to have a $15 billion impairment or something like that to get offside.
I perfectly understand, but just taking a page from how I've seen some other industries function, like gold, we've seen $50 billion, that's 50 of write-downs in the past 3 years. So large numbers are possible given the magnitude of the pullback we've seen in commodities, and that's what I'm trying to understand. What is the triggering mechanism, and ultimately, is this a company decision, or is this your auditor's decision to then year-end December 31st say, hey, guys, we need to do a mark-to-market here? That's what I'm just trying to understand. At what point does it become necessary to take that write-down?
Yeah. Well, it's our decision. It's not the auditor's decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The following question is from Brian MacArthur from UBS. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Sorry, not to go back to this impairment again, but how you made a statement, there's obviously a lot of assumptions, including taxes. How are the tax pools from the forwarding transaction, or what sort of tax rates do you use going forward for that impairment testing, given the pools out there, or do you just take a normalized statutory rate?
We take a normal statutory rate for that, and there are mineral taxes that are figured into that calculation as well.
Right, so you'd be using, like when you did your impairment, it'd be a cash tax rate of somewhere at 30 as opposed to, like, lower than that with the pools. Is that how it works?
I don't know.
You know, the pools are factored into the calculation, Brian, because it's basically a net present value analysis, and we have these pools that are available to us. So until they run out, they would be factored into the calculations.
And are they specifically allocated to certain assets or no? On the book value?
They're allocated to the coal business unit as a whole. They apply to them. The mineral taxes are a mine by mine allocation, because that's the way mineral taxes work.
Right. So when you'd use the tax pools from that basically for the impairment testing on the coal, then, I guess. Is that sort of the way it works?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The following question is from David Charles from Dundee Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I just have one quick question. Most of mine have been answered. You know, I was just wondering where we are on the collective bargaining agreements on your copper assets. I mean, if I'm correct, you're still negotiating or will begin negotiating for Antamina and Ekoyo and QB, and I'm wondering whether this might cause strikes or other curtailments in production.
Sure, it's Dale. I can provide some color on that. Actually, our Antamina agreement expires today, but we're in the middle of active negotiations. It's not unusual for those negotiations to go past the expiry date of the agreement, similar to last time round. As far as CDA and QB in Chile, we're also in early negotiations with all the unions there. And because we're in the middle of negotiations, I really don't want to comment any further than that.
Do you think that, given the current copper price environment, the negotiations will be more difficult or less difficult?
I think negotiations are always difficult, and I wouldn't anticipate it any more or less. There's nothing to indicate that it would be any different than last time around as far as the risk.
And maybe just in the same vein, has there been any disclosure as to the situation both at Lion Creek and one of your, I think it's, I'm not sure which, it's Coal Mountain, where we are on negotiations there as well?
Yeah, Ian here. We're carrying on negotiations on those with both those mines, it's an ongoing process, and we'll be continuing over time.
Thank you. The following question is from Alex Terentiew from Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Hey guys, just one more question on your coal business costs. Obviously, you've done a good job keeping costs down there so far this year. Well below the $89 to $93 per ton guidance, and you note in your presentation you're maintaining your cost guidance for the year. Is there any reason why we should think costs would go back up to that range? I mean, to even hit the low end, 89, I mean, you'd have to be kind of in the $94 per ton range for the rest of this year. I'm just trying to get an idea of, if you guys are being, extra conservative there or not.
I guess we certainly hope and expect that we can keep the costs that are under control, but that are under our control. But you know, there's always external factors, including diesel price, and we still have to make decisions about our final quarter four production. So we just thought it was prudent to leave the current range intact for the time being.
But given, you know, your current production plans, where costs are and so forth, I mean, you don't really see any reason why costs the second half this year should be much higher than they have been in the first half.
Well, I guess we'll be obviously endeavouring to keep cash positive, and as prices aren't going to be any higher than they were in the first half, then you can see where our costs have to be.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. The following question is from Jeremy Sussman from Clarkson. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. Can you just remind us how much of your coal is sold quarterly versus spot and in the mix of Chinese versus non-Chinese sales, which obviously is related to that?
So we've got about half of our coal that remains priced on a quarterly contract basis. Actually, what we've said for 2014 is that we had above 55% of our coal that was sold on shorter than quarterly basis. And that's up from around 40% in 2013. It was above 30% in 2012, and it was 15 to 25% prior to 2012. The sales split in 2014, you asked about China. China was somewhere around 25% or so of our sales in 2014. And we started reducing our sales to China from about Q4 of 2013.
Thank you. And then just following up real quick on one more question on costs. You know, regardless, I guess, of unit costs and keeping it maybe very high level and acknowledging that you're still in the decision-making process, do you see overall costs trending higher or lower over the next 12 months, kind of outside of, you know, currency swings?
Sorry, could you rephrase the question, please, or repeat the question?
Yeah, sure. So basically, just, you know, I understand that you're still in the decision-making process of on the operational side, but just generally speaking, you know, outside of currency, do you see coal costs trending higher or lower over the next 12 months from where they sat in Q2?
Okay. So unfortunately, it is related to some of those key decisions, but Ian, why don't I turn that one over to you?
Thanks, Don. Really, I think we've probably covered this, and I'm not sure we can give too much more colour than we have previously. Our endeavour will be to maintain our all of our operations cash positive, and so we're going to be doing everything we can to keep costs down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The following question is from Kerry Smith from Haywood Securities. Please go ahead.
Thanks, operator. Ian, are the mine plans for the coal operations just generally sufficiently flexible that you could rework the mine plans for the, you know, the next 1 to 3 years and significantly reduce your stripping requirement and still not sort of jeopardize the long-term mine plan? Like, could you take $100 million out of capitalized stripping for the next couple of years annually and still not screw up your mine plan?
I guess we've been reviewing our mine plans on an ongoing basis over the last couple of years, and we're still in that process. We are looking at every avenue we have to reduce costs in the short term, but of course we are keeping an eye on the long term, and we certainly aren't going to be doing anything which prejudices our ability to maintain production levels when the price recovery comes.
Oh, okay. I'll take that as a maybe. And just on Antamina, you had a good quarter there in terms of throughput. Is that throughput level sustainable, or was that a function of maybe it was softer ore in the quarter? I'm just wondering whether you could run at that rate on a go-forward basis.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it was an unusual quarter in the fact that it was record throughput. It does depend on the mix of ore feeds and where we are in our various phases of our mine plan. You know, the original design rate through the expanded facility was 130,000 tons per day. I would expect a more normal rate for production would be in that 145,000 tons per day, so still well above design. But probably not as high as in the second quarter on a continuous ongoing basis, although we are trying to continue to optimize throughput as we go forward. Countering that, I guess we do anticipate grades to recover on the copper side going forward in the second half of the year.
Okay, thank you, Dale.
Thank you. The next question is from David Wang from Morningstar. Please go ahead.
Thanks. I just had a couple of questions. First, if met coal prices remained where you signed the latest contract, would you be able to maintain the current level of guidance of 25, 26 million production after this year? For the tonnage that you're not producing, are those still profitable, or are you mainly taking them off to help the supply-demand balance in the market?
A good question, but again, not sure we could answer until we get to closer to next year and make an assessment on market conditions. I know you prefaced your question with saying if the prices stay there. I would repeat that all of our operations are cash positive now, so that would suggest that we keep going at the rate we are now or more. But our general philosophy is that you shouldn't put incremental tons into an oversupplied market. So, you know, those are two factors that we would look at. That's how we think about it, and we'd make our decision then.
All right, great. And for the decline in what you guys expect for capital costs in Fort Hills, can you guys give us some color onto what you think your portion of capital still left will come down to? Has it changed from your previous guidance?
I'm not sure we're talking about this. Go ahead. Ray Reeperson.
Sorry, I missed a question. Don, was it?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, you mentioned that you expect declining capital costs for Fort Hills. I was wondering if that's changed from what you previously expected, or is it about the same?
No, you may have misinterpreted our comments. We have not said that we expect declining capital costs. What we have said is that this is a terrific environment to be building Fort Hills, because elsewhere there have been significant cutbacks in capital devoted to the industry. So that makes the environment for building much better in terms of access to key skills and labor and deliveries and the rest of it. And we have been benefiting from that. So the project is right on track and meeting all its major milestones. That's sort of the state of play. I'm actually going there tomorrow and looking forward to it. But they've been making good.
Okay, so costs are about the same as what you had been projecting. I'm also wondering about copper. Copper's price has come down quite a bit, too. But on the cost side, across the industry, are you seeing the same sort of cost cuts as you have with met coal, or do you see it to a different degree?
Yeah, I think in copper, from a cost perspective, we are making good progress on how we manage contractors, how we manage labor, how we manage supplies, exchange rates in our favor in our Canadian operations. In Chile and Antamina, a good portion of our costs are exposed in U.S. dollars, so I guess to a lesser degree we're benefiting from the exchange rate there. But yeah, we're no different than coal. We're going to continue to try and drive our costs lower, and that's across the board at all operations.
All right, great. Thanks, guys.
Operator, we've gone well through our hours. We're going to cut off the Q&A now. If anybody is left in the queue with a question, we'd be happy to talk to you separately over the course of the day. I'm just going to turn it back to Don Lindsay for a moment to make some closing comments.
Yeah, the first thing I would say is that there are a couple of questions there on deferred stripping that suggest that at least a few a few individuals out there might benefit from a conversation to clarify your understanding of how diverged shippings work. So I strongly encourage you to call Greg Waller directly on that issue. And I'd say the same on things related to debt covenants and ratings and those kind of things, a number of issues that I think are based on, we know stories are circulating the market, and sometimes it's stories related to what people hope might happen based on their own investment position. But we have some pretty clear answers to those. We tried to give them today, but for those who are still wondering, don't hesitate to call Greg Waller directly. So then in closing, I just want to say that that we're very, very proud of this quarter because the operating team has really delivered. The finance team has really delivered as well in terms of our balance sheet and liquidity strength. And I point out that notwithstanding the fact that commodity prices are significantly down, our results are up. So look forward to speaking to you again at the end of Q3. Thanks very much.
Thank you. The conference call has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and we thank you for your participation.